those revolutionaries have to be wise.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we feature the former chairman of the Black Panther Party, Elaine Brown. Brown is the author of the books A Taste of Power and The Condemnation of Little B. She's the co-founder of Mothers Advocating Juvenile Justice and the National Alliance for Radical Prison Reform. She's also on the committee to free Chip Fitzgerald. She regularly lectures at colleges and universities around the country on New Age Racism in America.
A longtime prisoner advocate, Elaine Brown was a close advisor to prisoners who took part in the historic prison strikes in Georgia this past December. Here is her keynote speech from the opening night of the Counterinsurgency Convergence, which took place at Reed College, April 8th through the 10th, 2011.
Well, thank you, everyone, for coming out, and I'm glad that we are going to talk about some issues and hopefully, as a result, move forward and do some work. This is an area that's known to be progressive, so I don't know what's progressive in the United States anymore, but that's what they say. I want to thank Will Munger very, very much for really bringing me here and doing all the work to do that, and everyone else who participated in bringing me here and allowing me this opportunity to talk to you. I'm going to focus my remarks on this Georgia prisoner uprising and let you know up front that I'm bringing you something very extraordinary, and that is the voice of one of the prisoner leaders that I'm getting ready to call and put on this microphone and see if we can hear what he has to say, so that way you will have an opportunity to hear what a lot of other people have not heard, and that is the voice of the men themselves, because they don't have any voice outside other than people like me. I want to just start out, however, by just relating something that I talked to some fellow recently whom we were in a debate. Well, it was more like an argument. And I said to him, well, why do you think 50% of the prisoners in America are black? And he said, I have no idea. And what that told me was that he has no idea that there's racism remaining in America, or that either something must be wrong with black people. Maybe we have a criminal gene. You know, there are people who actually have studied things like this as though it had some scientific basis. We'll get into that in a minute. But the bottom line is, I'm going to talk tonight about why it is that 50% of the prisoners in America are black. And the reason I'm going to do that is because, obviously, since we black people represent only 13% of the population, it's a reflection, and a very clear reflection, of exactly what is going on, what is wrong in this society, and what could be righted if we really want to make a difference. I'm going to talk about why that is and how that happened. But let it suffice it to say that there are over 2 million people in prison in America today, as you know. I'm sure most of you are conscious of that, and the fact that that number is the highest number of people in prison of any country in the world, and it represents the highest ratio of prisoners in any population in any country in the world, including countries like, say, Libya, a country that happens to be in Africa, by the way, and not in the Arab world. Among those 2 million people in prison is a young man who, when I met him, and everybody knows him in the prison system now as Little B, his name is Michael Lewis, and Will mentioned that I wrote a book about this boy named Little B called The Condemnation of Little B. In 1997 in Atlanta, Little B was 13 years old. He was arrested for a murder, and which parenthetically he did not commit. And I only say that because I don't know how relevant it is to say that a young 13-year-old is arrested and tried as an adult for murder and convicted and sentenced as an adult to life in prison, which is what happened to Little B. But I want to go, because you know this is the only country in the world that tries children as adults. It puts children on trials. You know, in 13 years old, you can't buy cigarettes, you can't buy liquor, you can't drive a car, you can't vote. You really can't do anything independently. You have to go to school. You have all kinds of rules and restrictions. you actually are not considered a full citizen in the sense that everyone understands that a 13-year-old cannot make decisions based on any understanding consequences. And so we don't hold children to the standard of an adult, children being people under 18 years old. But when it comes to so-called crime, we change our minds and we hold people to a standard of an adult standard and put them in prison. But in any case, Little B was arrested, and when I saw the headlines in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, I was just so shocked to see this little teeny face of this little boy saying that this thug had killed an innocent father, was charged with the killing of an innocent black father. That was how it was cast. It all took place in an area of Atlanta called the Bluff. It's an area that we have in most cities in America. The Bluff is that area where poor black people live, called the ghetto, used to be the ghetto, the inner city, whatever you want to call it. And it's the place where, you know, you have no real commerce other than drugs. You can buy crack cocaine, powder cocaine, you can buy dro, you can buy purple, you can buy ecstasy, you can buy whatever you want in the Bluff. And you can drive by and buy it. You can call up from Georgia Tech, which is nearby, or Spelman or Morehouse, which are also nearby, and you can roll through the Bluff and buy whatever you want. And it's one of the roughest neighborhoods in Atlanta, but people generally don't get killed there buying drugs because nobody's trying to kill their customers, you know, and drive away commerce. The only other thing that goes on is you have a little store, you know, that little store where somebody is selling everything from human hair or yak hair, or you can buy some potato chips, you can buy some popcorn, you can buy some weed, maybe you can buy whatever you want to buy, but you cannot buy a tomato or a piece of lettuce or anything like that. As a matter of fact, if you want to be a vegan, you do not want to live in the Bluff because you will be dead. You know, there will be no vegans in the Bluff unless you plan on eating some weed. You know what I mean? And that's about it. So that's where he grew up, and by the time he was 8 years old, Little B's mother was a crackhead, and his house was the crack house. And you know, I find that phenomenal, because when I was a kid, I didn't know anybody was on crack, and people go, wow, that's interesting. I wonder why. Well, there was a reason for that. There wasn't any crack when I grew up. And suddenly, you know, we had these neighborhoods inundated with drugs and so forth. We could talk about that another time if you want to ask some questions, talk about Gary Webb's wonderful book called Dark Alliance and how the CIA promoted the distribution of cocaine, cheap cocaine, in the black communities of America, particularly in the California area and Atlanta and Florida and areas where along the coast, mainly to transfer funds to the Contras, the same Contras that were involved in the gun deals in Iran, if you know about all of that. But in any case, the Bluff was a hotbed of all of this, and a guy got killed on one of those corners. The case was an absurd case because nobody's going to that little store where you can buy cookies and human hair and a beeper and whatever else, but you cannot buy any real food. Nobody's going there to buy a soda, as the wife alleged. You only go up into that neighborhood to buy one thing, and that's some dope. But in any case, this guy gets killed, and he's cast as this good guy. And in the meantime, there's Little B, and he's cast as this evil thug. As a matter of fact, the black mayor of Atlanta referred to Little B as an evil in the city. But he didn't talk about the evils that were in the city, such as the Bluff, and how a kid like Little B could grow up. And by the time he's 11, the state comes in and finds that his mother is not taking care of him, and he's considered a deprived child and is removed from the home, which really didn't make much difference because there wasn't any home there other than a crack house where a whole bunch of people slept. And I asked him when I first started talking to him, well, how many people? Were there a lot of people sleeping in your house at night, you know, in the house where you live? And he said, no, not a lot of people. I said, well, how many do you think? He said, no more than about 10 or 12, sleeping on the floor, what have you, doped up. By the time he was 8, he recognized to take a little sister, 5 years old, take her to school, comb her hair, do whatever they could do, and go to school to get breakfast because that was the only way they were going to eat any food. He said, mother smoked up every dime for the food. He said, my mother smoked up the water. If he were an aberration, or, you know, if he were just one kid in one neighborhood, then we could say, well, this is a sad little story. But unfortunately, there are very many little bees in Atlanta, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, Detroit, Boston, you know, L.A., and what have you. We know that there are probably millions of children in America who are living without any real support in the home. And, you know, when people say, well, the home is not helping them in school, so, you know, the schools can't do everything. Well, in the case of Little B, obviously it couldn't. I called the school, I called everyone and said, you know, did you notice that from 11 years old, once he was taken out of the home and put into a group home, he ran away and he went back to the Bluff and he sold dope for his brother. and a lot of older guys, and those are the same people that testified against him at trial because it was their killing that they let him take the hit for, and he was convicted in November of 1997. Now, around the same time of his case, there was a kid right here in Oregon named Kip Kinkle. He was a 14-year-old kid, a white kid, who was charged with, well, he wasn't charged with, Kip got up one morning and killed mom and dad, you know. Dragged them all downstairs and stuffed them up underneath the house, put a backpack full of handguns on his back, had an assault rifle in his hand and a hunting knife taped to his chest, went off to middle school and shot up 25 people before they took him down. Three of them died. So Kip killed five people that day and tried to kill the police that arrested him. And he tried to take the knife off his chest and stabbed the police. Kip actually didn't even get killed, which I find amazing because we all know that had he been black, Kip would have been dead. The next day when the school, you know the scene, everybody's like wandering around, 25 people been shot, three people are dead, all this terrible tragedy going on. And there was a big banner in front of the school and it said, "Why, Kip? You know, why'd you do it?" Looking at too many violent videos, feeling isolated in exurbia. Was he one of those kids who was being taunted, bullied? What was Kip's problem? Everybody started examining this. Throughout America, people began to question why these young people, so many of them, in Columbine and elsewhere, why were they killing people? What was going on among our youth? Not one person called Kip Kinkle a thug. Don't even think of Kip as a thug today. But my boy is a thug who was charged with the killing of one person, not five, including his mother and father. And nobody ever thought of Kip as a criminal. Nobody thought of him as a thug. He was a good kid that just did a bad thing. What happened? We need to look at this. Well, you're right. We should have looked at it. Anybody whose mother named him Kip, knowing his last name was Kinkle, you know good and well he had some problems at home. You killed your mother and father. It must be clear there was something going on in your house that was a little bizarre. And first of all, where did you get all those guns from? You know, Kip was messed up. And we need to look at that. But we don't need to condemn him to life in prison like we did little B. But we make a distinction in America when it's a white kid and a black kid who is a black kid. Crime in America has a black face. That's one of the examples of things. It's a political question. And the reason we know it's a political question, there's a black-on-black crime going on right now, the biggest one probably ever in the history of America since we've been talking about black-on-black crime, and that's the Obama assault on Libya. If you go into Libya and just accidentally kill some people from a NATO airplane, they're going to say, oops, just an accident. You killed a couple people on the ground, happened to be some pregnant women or some children or whatever. We're going to give you a medal. You're trying to stop that evil Gaddafi from killing people by killing some other people. We don't call that murder. We call that a humanitarian effort in Libya, don't we? So we know that murder, that killing someone is not a crime unless I say it's a crime and I'm the one that holds the law books and the guns that back up the law books in my hands. Unfortunately, we don't have any anti-war movement to even say one mumbling word about what's going on in Afghanistan or anywhere else. It's really shocking to me that so many young people, you know, we did have a lot of young people that used to be in the streets against the Vietnam War back in the day. There is nothing. We say nothing about what's going on in this war, and so therefore we don't say anything about what's going on in the war on people at home also. You know, war was not a part of Dr. King's dream. You know, people say Dr. King had a dream. They don't know what the dream was. Something about some little children holding hands going up a mountain. We don't really know. You know, he had a dream. We don't know. Whoever gets a hold of it decides what it is. We're going to talk about what it was. But one thing it was not war. Dr. King said, well, how can I talk about nonviolence to these young black men who are tearing up America, throwing Molotov cocktails all over America? How can I talk to them about nonviolence and use the use of nonviolence to redress their grievances when this country sends them to kill innocent people in Vietnam? He said, I can't. How can we talk about anything in this country when we're murdering people all over the world? Talking about some budget cuts. What should we do about the budget? Take some of that money from all that killing, from that killing machine that you call the Defense Department. That's not difficult. Easy. There's a whole bunch of money you can take from there and finance every single thing that you want, from education to health care and everything else. I'm not trying to buy health care insurance. I'm trying to get some health care, but I'm not trying to buy any insurance. In any case, Michael Lewis, little B, that was 1997, and as I say, he was convicted and sentenced to prison for life. Life in Georgia at that time was a mandatory minimum of 14 years. Today, it's a mandatory minimum of 30 years. 14 years later is now. In March of this year, last month, right after Michael's birthday, his 28th birthday, he was denied parole the basis of denial was nature of the crime. Nature of the crime means that you will never get out, because if you're going to be denied based on the nature of the crime, obviously the nature of crime cannot ever change. So you will never be able to be free if we looked at the parole board, and we can talk about the particulars of the parole board. But the other part is that Michael grew up in prison, and even though I have been his sort of mother, he's called me, he adopted me as his mother, and I adopted him back, and I said to someone, that's my son. And so there's like all these people saying, well, did you actually have him? You know, this is not your biological son. You know, it makes my eyes glaze over. No, you know, so I said, well, he's my son for all intents and purposes. So he is my son, and he considers me his mother. And he's still in prison there in Georgia. And he was one of the people who was a part of that uprising of people in Georgia on December the 9th of last year.
You're listening to Elaine Brown, former chairman of the Black Panther Party and longtime prisoner advocate, on Circle A Radio.
Uprising of people in Georgia, probably around 10,000 men. People said, why do you keep saying men? Well, because that's the only prisons that were involved in the uprising. The prisons that were involved mainly were Macon State and Smith, Telfair, Hayes, Augusta, what have you. There are approximately 2,000 men in each prison, and at least five of those prisons we know had a shutdown. And what that shutdown was they determined that they were not going to work. At first, it was going to be a one-day strike, and they just said, we're not going to work for free. We're not going to work at all until we get the things that we want. We're only going to have this one-day protest, though, and we're going to make this a nonviolent protest. I mean, these are some guys that could have, you know, they could have taken over the prison like Attica, like Lucasville. But they knew what the results were going to be, and so they had a strategy that was very powerful. They just refused to step out of their cell. They said, everybody's going to just lay down. That's how they put it. And it was something very powerful about that language for me. So we're just going to lay down. We're not going to get up. We're not going to work. Now, the prison, imagine, it's really a difficult thing when your slaves won't work, you know. When you tell your slaves to get up and step out the cell, and when you have control over the situation, then that's one thing. But when you lose control and they just say, it's not that I'm doing anything, I'm doing nothing. I'm not going to do anything that you ask. I'm not coming out to eat. I'm not coming out. And they handed out food. They saved top ramen or whatever that is. They distributed it to every other people, the people that didn't have money. And they said, lock it down, brothers. Don't get up. And that was the blacks who were in various sets in the prison, including the Muslims. You had whites from the Aryan Nation. And you had the Mexican mafia, what have you. And you had some Rastafarians, one of whom recently called me the other day to tell me they had retaliated by beating him pretty badly and cutting off his locks. You had all of these groups that have been fighting and who are pretty tough guys and who decided they're going to throw down their knives and everything. They're not going to fight each other anymore. They recognized a common enemy. They didn't fall in love and go off singing Kumbaya, believe me. They're all tough. They all said, but we have conditions here that are so terrible that we're all suffering under, that we decided that we're going to do this thing this day. And we don't know what's going to happen, and we don't know what the result is going to be, but this is what it's going down, and it went down. Now, a lot of the news reports that came out about that so-called strike focused on the fact that a lot of this was done by people connecting through cell phones, which I'm getting ready to do. And that was like the big piece. And, you know, every time anybody asked me about it, some people were like, oh, don't say they're on cell phones. Well, how am I going to say they're communicating all this stuff to all of us? You know, they were calling up the press, some of them, from their cell phones. They were saying the same thing. You remember when Dr. King was killed during the Memphis garbage strike? Remember the great sign that said, I am a man? We all saw that great photograph of the march that the man has saying, I am a man, I want to be treated as a man. That's what these men were saying. We're still human beings despite our condition as prisoners, we're still human beings. So in any case, I want to see if I can get this guy on the phone. I got to hear the music while my party is reached.
You want to bump it?
We could wrap that. Yeah, hold on a minute. I'm going to put you on the speaker and see if it works, all right?
How y'all doing?
Well, you want to just tell us about why you organized, why you were organizing the strike, and who was involved and how you did it in terms of the number, the kind of people that were involved?
Well, we had to get together, you know, without doing all the crazy nonsense, try to act out 12 of these folks by laying down, right? No working, you know what I'm saying? So somebody, we can get some kind of attention right down here from, you know, all across Georgia down here, right? Because the way they was treating us down here, you know, a lot of things that we don't have down here, man, you know what I'm saying, that we trying to get, like, with the help that Elaine gave us. A lot of us got together, you know what I'm saying?
And what about the question of the different sets of blacks, the whites, Mexicans, what have you? You got together with all of them, right?
We just got together, and everybody who was, like, over, like, the Mexicans, you know, the white, the brothers, you know, we just sat out, and all of us had a conversation about what we need to do, bring this thing together, you know, so everybody agreed on it, and so as they seen that we trying to get some kind of process in prison, right? Everybody got together and said, let's do it.
Well, listen, I'm not going to keep you. I just wanted everyone to know that one of the leaders of the strike was here and that you are still struggling. And can you just say one thing about what you were fighting for and talk about some of the things that are going on very quickly? What are the issues that you wanted to bring up?
The time that they were giving us, the way they were treating us, the way they treating us and him, doing all this labor for free, no education inside, healthcare, you know, a lot of things on the inside, man, that we need that we're not getting, that they telling our people on the outside that they're giving us and they're not giving us, you feel what I'm saying?
And what about people being put in the hole and beaten up and everything?
Oh, yeah, now that's a big one right there. Now, you know, we had one guy down here, man, you know, they really killing guys, getting away with it, you know, like it's legal, right?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
You've been put in the hole yourself a number of times, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but just stand up for what's right, right? But, you know, when you're rebellious against them like that, you know, that's why I had to tell the other brothers, you know, try not to act that, you know what I'm saying, physically. But just sit down. Once you sit down, it ain't nothing they can do.
All right, brother. I'm going to let you go because I'm going to continue talking to the young people who are here, and hopefully they will be inspired to support, get involved in the whole movement of getting human rights for prisoners, okay?
Okay. Tell the young people, I say, stay up out of this place.
Stay out of it, okay. All right. I love you. Talk to you later. All right. So that's a good, you know, something that you heard something about what was going on. One of the things that, as I said, I want to talk about in terms of how this all happened, I want to just reflect back. I like to talk about Dr. King only because everybody can identify with Dr. King. If I say Huey Newton said it, people are like, what? You know, if I say Rat Brown, they're like, who? So, you know, I use Dr. King's message because at the end of his life, he really became revolutionary ideologically. He actually been one for quite a while, and we can talk about that a little more. But one of the things he said toward the end of his life in 1967, he said, you know, we've achieved civil rights, one could say, because of the 64, 65 Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts having been passed under the Johnson administration. And he said, and so this is where we are now. He said, but when I look out, he said, then I have to say, well, if we achieve civil rights, where do we go from here? And I would ask the same question today. Where do we go from here? And he said, in order to know where we can go, we have to know where we are. And he said, when I look at the condition of black people, I see that when the Constitution was written, we were 60% of a man of a person, as the Constitution said, that blacks would be counted as 2/3 of a person for representational purposes, not valued as anything, but just counted as something. And he said, but now I think that we're less than that. We're 50% because we have half of what is good and double of what is bad in America. And so even though we have our so-called civil rights, we don't have these rights. Now, the reason that I'm focusing on blacks is because this is the clearest example of what is going on in this country internally. And we pretend now, well, we got a black president, allegedly, and therefore we have a black president, so everything must be all right. But when we look at where we are today, in order for us to talk about where do we go, and we look at where we are today, we look at how black people, as I say, represent 50% of the prison population. Of course, we have the highest unemployment, lowest education levels, and so forth and so on. So the question is why, and so how did we get here? Either something is wrong, and there are people who actually did study. There was a study done at Columbia University on whether or not there was a criminal gene. Took some young boys who all had brothers in prison to find out if there was any kind of genetic relationship to crime and race, which is just beyond stupid, but certainly goes to the kind of reasoning that Gobineau used, that Hitler then used to talk about the inherent evil of Jews or what have you. You know, we have other people with scientific racism, so forth and so on. The latest discourse, though, that came up that had to do with this prison piece came under the Clinton administration. You know, we all like to talk about Bush. It's so easy to talk about Bush, the two Bushes, you know, whatever. But we act as though there's some major difference between Bush and Clinton or Bush and Obama, Obama and Clinton, you know, as though some big leaps and things happened under these different administrations. But under the Clinton administration, a very interesting thing happened, and he proselytized his position once in the late November of 1993, as the first year after he was elected president. You know, a lot of black people ran around saying that they thought Bill Clinton was the first black president. I wasn't one of them. But you have people like Toni Morrison and Chris Rock. You know, I don't know how I relate those two people. But anyway, talk about Clinton was the first black president. I mean, I don't even know why they said it was that his lips were big. I mean, I don't know what they're talking about. He could play halfway, play the saxophone, or he ate watermelon or whatever it was. He was a Southern, he was from Arkansas, you know. He used to eating watermelon and a bunch of other stuff, but I don't want to go there.
You are listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM. Tonight we're bringing you a speech by Elaine Brown, recorded on April 8th, 2011 at Reed College in Portland. Again, this is Elaine Brown.
So in any case, Clinton gets up at the podium where Martin Luther King gave his last speech. You know that great speech where he says, "Not fearing any man tonight." That was the one he gave at the end of his life. "I've been to the mountaintop, seen the other side. I know we as a people will get there. I might not get there with you." You know, that great speech, that last moment of his life in Memphis, Tennessee. And there's Clinton standing in that same spot, in that same church, or a sea of black people listening to him. And he's down there in Memphis to tell black people something, send a message. And he says, "And here's the message." And he said, "You know, if Martin Luther King was standing by my side today, what would he say?" And I just found that, you know, I always tell young people the first thing you have to do when anybody says anything, or whenever you're listening to something or ever thinking about it, you have to have a correct analysis. So you have to kind of analyze what people are saying and not just like listen to it. But when you think back over it, you know, analyze what does it mean. Now, what is the possibility that Martin Luther King would have been standing by the side of Bill Clinton then or at any other time? This was a racist from Arkansas who was probably spitting at the people going into the high school at Little Rock, in Central High School in Little Rock. There's no chance that when Martin Luther King was alive, he would have been standing next to Bill Clinton. But anyway, I digress. Here, Martin was standing by my side. What would he say, Clinton says? And now Clinton is going to tell us what Martin Luther King would say if he were alive today. I mean, this is an incredible leap of faith, not to count, incredibly arrogant. And he tells all these black people, this is what Martin Luther King would say. He would say, "I died for your freedom, but look what you've done." Ooh. And people were like, "You're right, Master Clinton. You're messed up. Martin died for our freedom, and still we're bad off. We got all this black-on-black crime, all these unwed teen mothers, and the breakdown of the black family." That's what he said Dr. King would say. I think Dr. King might have opposed NAFTA while he was around at the time, because we have plenty of evidence of that. We don't have any evidence about this other stuff. We just have Bill Clinton telling us. That's what Dr. King would say. And so we have to examine, you know, what do you mean
all this black-on-black crime. The majority of crime in America is committed by white people against white people. Why? Because white people are the majority of people in America. It's not very complicated, you know. There's nothing exotic about black-on-black. I mean, people, most so-called crimes are committed, they're crimes of convenience. You know, you're not going to get on a train and go across town and snap somebody's purse. If you don't have any money, you probably can't get on a train to go across town and snap. You know, people don't go out of their way to commit crimes, you know, so it's not unusual. But Clinton has now convinced black people that the reason that you have all these problems is something's wrong with you, and I'm going to fix it for you. You got this crime, you got these unwed teen mothers. Now, that's another one. You know, it's like, unwed teen mothers, how does that work? Oh, they're a drain on the society because the welfare payments that we're paying, which are what of the budget, to keep these illegitimate children, all these little black bastards, Shaniqua's children, Chantanay and them, you know, we're trying to keep their children from having anything. So I'm going to do something about your problems. But let's examine the breakdown of the black family. That happened back in the 1600s when you started snapping people up out of Africa and bringing them into Jamestown. Okay, so let's not talk about how the black family was living for 250 years in America under the institution of slavery. But nevertheless, we are the problem to ourselves. There's nothing wrong with America anymore. Something wrong with black people. And we have bought into that kind of neoliberal ideology, what I call new age racism, where you are responsible for your cancer. If you were eating broccoli, you wouldn't have breast cancer. You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing, you know. You know, it's like, it's your fault you have this stuff. And you need to fix it, because there's nothing wrong in the scheme of things. So we bought into that, and Bill Clinton says, and so I'm going to help you, I'm going to give you a crime bill that's going to be so powerful that all these career criminals and these thugs like Little B, we're going to get them off of your streets. And people said, thank you, that's what's wrong. We need to get rid of all these bad black boys. Even people like Jesse Jackson said that. So now we get the Omnibus Crime Bill of 1994. Which Newt Gingrich and the Republicans were promoting, but Bill Clinton took credit for it. The same way Obama's getting ready to give us some right-wing legislation just to stay afloat, and everybody's going to buy into it, like we bought into Libya and Afghanistan and so forth. So, but we're not saying anything about it. So Clinton gives us a three strikes crime bill. The other part of that legislation was to adjudicate children as adults for certain crimes, seven so-called deadly sins. As a result, from 1994 to 2004, the prison system in America doubled and became the largest prison system in America. We can thank Bill Clinton for that, but nobody ever pays attention to, oh yeah, Bush did this, Bush did that, but aren't Bush and Clinton going off into something, doing some deals in Haiti and some? The second thing, of course, was as a side point in terms of the prison question, but not a side point in fact, was the so-called unwed teen mother. Of course, Bill Clinton followed up his crime legislation with the 1996 welfare reform bill, criminalizing poor women and their children and telling them you're not going to get a dime if you lay up and have another child out of wedlock, and then you definitely have to get one if you don't go get a job somewhere. And I don't care what kind of job it is. And in some cases, like in New York, when Giuliani implemented that legislation, he made people work for their welfare, which had people think, well, that sounds right, doesn't it? Well, not exactly, because you're not getting minimum wage. If you're working for a welfare check, you're working as the same number of hours, but you're not getting minimum wage. And not only that, you want to cut out the possibility of somebody who can get a minimum wage job of having that job. But we never saw that coming. The feminists were all right with the welfare reform bill, and the blacks didn't care about the three strikes crime bill, and we just been sitting around letting all this stuff go on. Now, this mass incarceration of blacks is, however, not unusual. And the thing that his brother was talking about in terms of talking about working and for free in the prison systems of Georgia, you can get paid not one dime for work. See, people talk about the prison industrial complex, but they don't have a real vision of what the realities are on the ground. The realities on the ground is that people are working every day and not getting paid any money. Well, now the reason I say that there's something connected to all of this is the 13th Amendment in this particular case. And the 13th Amendment, of course, calls for the abolition of involuntary servitude. And then people go, well, they can do it because it says except as a punishment for crime. So I want to just go back a little bit through the history of things and how we got from, black people, why black people have such a great number in the prison system, and we begin to see the value of the whole prison system as a part of the scheme, the same scheme that was put into place when this country was founded, and which we ultimately realized was a form of a social construct that was an economic structure that was a capitalist structure. And so it serves a capitalist structure, and if we don't understand that, then the whole thing is just a wash. You know, this stuff doesn't happen out of the sky. It happens for very concrete reasons. People want money, and they exploit other people. It's not very complicated. In any case, barring the 250 years of slavery before, when the Civil War started, the South seceded. People like to say, well, it wasn't over slavery, but it wasn't over slavery, but it was over the question of the expansion of the country. But when you read the secession statements of South Carolina and all the others, Mississippi, what have you, what you will realize is they all say slavery is our economic engine. We cannot live without it. You are cutting us off. And you should check those statements out because they have a lot to do with this country because, as we know, in 1776, when the country was founded, it was a slave-holding nation. This was a country founded as a slave-holding nation, and there was only one group of people who were slaves. Don't let anybody tell you about the three Irish indentured servants. There were only one group of people who were slaves, and they were African people of African descent. So after those, from 1660 to 1861, 250 years, there's this argument over how the country will go forward, but really it's over the rise of industrialization, just as we're facing the end of industrialization and the move into a global technological society in a different form of production and a distribution of things and wealth. So we have in 1863, the Southern States and Confederacy were winning the war, and Lincoln says what to do, since Lincoln was supporting the idea of the Union, although he did say, I wouldn't free one slave, it would keep the Union together. And everyone who's ever studied anything about Lincoln knows that's a pretty well-known documented statement. And talks about the inherent superiority of white people and so forth and so on. But in any case, and Lincoln says, listen, we're going to do something to win this war, so I'm going to undercut the labor force in the seceding states by freeing the slaves in the seceding states who are the blacks. And so he issues the Emancipation Proclamation as a necessary war measure, which is what he says it is. He says, this is not about slaves, this is about a war measure. I've got to figure out how to undercut and undermine the backbone of labor that the South has. And when he did that, a lot of blacks just left the southern plantations and so forth and started walking toward the north to find their way away from slavery. And that undermined the southern, you know, Tyler was starting to burn and all kinds of stuff was happening, you know, the nostalgia of it all. And so they ran around and blacks were running back and forth. By the time Sherman was about to burn Atlanta, he had, you know, thousands and thousands of blacks walking behind him. And in fact, when he did the great march to the sea, to Savannah, he had many, many hundreds and thousands of blacks walking behind him, which is why in 1865, when the war was over, Sherman issued Field Order Number 15, which said that every former slave family should be issued 40 acres of tillable land so that they can start a life in this country as non-slaves. Now, Sherman wasn't exactly an abolitionist, but Sherman was a practical man. He saw these walking around with nothing to do. You got 4 million ex-slaves. What are you going to do with these people? So he said, we're going to give them this land, all this confiscated lands in the South, along the southeast corridor there from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, to Florida, along that coastal lands. And of course, many of the people moved on, but by the time Andrew Johnson got to be president after Lincoln was killed, it wasn't but a minute before they removed those people from that land. And that left blacks in a very peculiar position. That left us as people who weren't enslaved but who had no rights as citizens and therefore had no possibilities of surviving. And at the same time, before the 13th Amendment was ratified, there was something called black codes were put together. And these were laws criminalizing certain behaviors of blacks. And one of the greatest crimes that a black could commit at that time, now, whites could not commit, were not guilty of the same crime, but for blacks, the crime was vagrancy. Now, why do I tell you all of this? Because vagrancy was the reason that you were convicted. Now, there were no big prisons like we have today, okay? So what did you do as a convict? Well, you were leased out and sent to do work on a farm or in a coal mine or in a steel production as steel was beginning to be produced. And you were put into a chain gang. You know, that's why we say the chain gang. You were chained together, you built the railroads, you did all this stuff. And so blacks went from being a slave class to a criminal class. We were the only people in the class. We were the only people for whom vagrancy was a crime, punishable by being on the chain gang, was the South Carolina Railroad Company. And all the industrialists were now finding a way to re-enslave as Douglas Blackman in his wonderful book called The Re-Enslavement of Blacks in America. Douglas Blackman's book is wonderful, B-L-A-C-K-M-O-N. You should read it. And so he documents, and we have all the documents to show that massive numbers of blacks were effectively re-enslaved, either that or sharecropping. Now, why is this important? Because it puts blacks in the same position of working for free as before slavery, and before the 13th Amendment, and as now. Same group of people doing the same thing for the same reason. For cheap labor, for the production of other products and things, for the development of wealth in America. So when we talk today about the blacks who are in prisons, and the majority in Georgia, almost 80% are black, when we talk about people being going to prison, then we have to connect these dots and have this historical understanding, because if we don't, then we start looking at things. Now, I just want to go over a little more of this history. The struggle that blacks then faced was to survive. You know, when we get to the Plessy versus Ferguson decision in 1896, blacks really had nowhere to go. Well, how were you going to get a house? You didn't have any money. You couldn't live anywhere. You didn't have any housing. People just walking around, literally. Building little shanty towns in New Orleans and what have you, so forth and so on. And working for the same people they had worked for before. The Plessy decision, the Homer Plessy decision, was really just about, you know, whether or not there was any possibility that blacks could have an equal share in the society as citizens. And of course, Homer Plessy was a very light-skinned black, called himself an octoroon, and got on a train in New Orleans. And they told him to get off. They said, you think you might look white to some people, but you don't, if you're black, get back into the back of the train and sit in that bad car. And Plessy took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, look, Plessy, we cannot make you white, and we can't make these white people like you. The only thing we can tell you that the accommodations can be separate as long as they're equal. And that sounds like a good plan, doesn't it? Some people think, you know, well, separate but equal sounds all right. Well, it'd be nice, if it'd be all right if you had a train. But nobody was building an equal car for black people. So you were separate, but there was no equal car for you. So if you wanted to get on the train, you would get on the back of the train, the bus, or whatever it was. And you would not get an employment, and you would not be in a union, as the industrial unions rose up, as massive numbers of European immigrants came to populate America so that the industrial fields of the North could be worked by the new immigrant population. Just as a side point, don't you find it interesting that they had the nerve enough to be telling people today, worried about somebody's immigrant, talking about some Mexicans, or where are their documentation? Now, none of those people that came in those late 1800s, no, they didn't have any papers, but what? Your name used to be, you know, whatever it was, and now it's down to being brown. Because nobody could understand. Those people didn't have paperwork. Like, nobody was, they were invited in to come to work. That's why they were here. They came to work. Give me your tired, your poor, yes. So they come here and work for free. That's why they were here. Nobody gets that. There was a whole wave of Europeans that came in. Most of the people that talk about their families can go back to those generations that came in through the Port of New York. Bottom line, though, for blacks, we were here, and we had no place to go and no place, nothing to be. So we were fighting for food, for clothing, for housing, for education, for everything. And the Plessy decision absolutely destroyed the last little hope that we had, because it said separate is all right. So the segregation, the Jim Crow, whites only, blacks have to go in the back. There were no accommodations for blacks. And we didn't have anything to accommodate ourselves. You know, that's why Booker T. Washington said, we need our own money. Marcus Garvey movement started out talking about economic independence. And then you had NAACP and all these other various efforts to try and find a way for black people to live in America until you get up to 1954 and the Brown decision, which never overturned Plessy, because nothing has ever overturned Plessy. And the Brown decision is little Linda Brown, you know, father says separate is not equal in the public schools, and everybody in the court said, you're right, let's desegregate the schools, and never have we had this kind of bloodshed, not since the Civil War, when one black child tried to go to school and sit with some white children. It's amazing when we think about it, because we act like this stuff never happened. That, now we're already in 1954, almost 100 years since the end of slavery. And all we're talking about is for some children to go to school. Don't have housing, don't have jobs, don't have a house, don't have our 40 acres, don't have food, don't have medical care. So you're talking about a whole population of people that are just wandering around still, 54, after the Civil War, I mean after the World War I and World War II, the great black migrations of both of those periods. Finally we get to 55, Rosa Parks, like Plessy, says, I want a seat on the bus. I'm paying my money, I just want to sit on the bus. Can you imagine we're actually arguing for a seat on the bus in 1955? And that's the big moral moment when Dr. King comes in, the Montgomery bus boycott, and everyone recognizes. Why? Because TV is showing it. We don't show that stuff today. That's what's really wrong, isn't it? TV's, we have things like, let's discuss whatever that guy's name, Charlie Sheen forever. You know, we know more about Charlie Sheen than any human being should know about Charlie Sheen. You know, how irrelevant is he? But we know a lot about him, or we talk a lot about him, but we don't talk about people dying in Afghanistan. We don't know anything about it. But we got more information. Or if you go into the hip-hop thing, you know, it used to be like, who doesn't like who? Who's got the big arguments? You know, the new reality TV show, people know more about Jersey Shore. Yeah, I mean, seriously, that's all we think about. We're just like walking around with, and you have people say, the Twitter thing. You know, people are Twittering, I ate breakfast this morning. This is what I ate. It's like, this is more information. These people are not even relevant to anything. Just walk around here talking about themselves all day long. But one of the things that we had then is they didn't get the drill, so everybody heard Dr. King's voice. Everybody saw those dogs. Everybody saw the Montgomery bus. They could see this stuff, and the world saw it, and America was ashamed. And it called itself the land of the free, home of the brave, and all that. And so you had the beginning of this uprising again in this country, a freedom movement. We never called it civil rights, and so you had the, you know, call it freedom movement, oh, freedom over me, and before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave. And the rise of organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was headed by people that you probably know of, H.R.A.P. Brown and Stokely Carmichael. You had the Congress of Racial Equality, of course, you had the Urban League and the NAACP, you had the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party with Fannie Lou Hamer. All of these people trying to find different ways to access basic rights. Access basic rights. We're not, you know, it's a basic right to have food. Because if you have to buy food and you don't have any money, the idea is you're condemned to death, right? You just dead on arrival. Don't have any money to pay for those little cancer treatments, you're dead. Nobody cares. Your life is measured by how much money you have in order for you to survive. But there are some basic things that we as human beings know is wrong. They're wrong. It's wrong to tell someone, if you're a little kid, we can see it when we see children. Well, your mother's on crack, that's too bad. You're 8 years old, you don't have any money, we can't help you. We're not taking care of all these bad people's children. We're tired of it. You know what I mean? We don't want to take care of any of these people. And then you can't have an abortion. So if you have that child, we're not prepared to take care of it. I mean, the whole thing is you know, we don't have any analysis going on, any kind of human ideology that's driving anything. So the moral voice of Dr. King was very powerful. And then the Black Panther Party comes into being, and we talked about revolutionary change. We said we wanted freedom for black people, but we recognized that our freedom could not come in the existing scheme. That in order for us to be free, the whole scheme had to change. We were Marxist-Leninists, just so you don't get it twisted. You know, people like, oh, they were national. And we were Marxist-Leninists, and we ultimately began to form coalitions with, you know, with the Brown Berets, with the Young Lords, with the Red Guard, with the white organization. I always like to say they were like left-leaning Timothy McVeighs called the Young Patriots out of Chicago. Everybody had to pick that up. That is pretty interesting. We formed international coalitions. These were real coalitions. With the PAC in South Africa, with Frelimo in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, pardon me, with ZANU in Zimbabwe. We supported the war, we supported the efforts of the Vietnamese people for national liberation. Matter of fact, we called not for peace in Vietnam, but for victory for the Viet Cong. Of course, you can imagine this didn't endear us to the American government. They referred to us as the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States and did everything to try to destroy us and just about did. And you had all kinds of other things, but among the things that we did in terms of trying to organize people, we also organized around questions of food, so we started free breakfast programs to point out New York Human Right to Eat. started free food programs, free clinics in the communities, organized people around that, started talking about and demonstrating the right of the people in this country. If you want to have say, we have the right to bear arms, and we have the right to self-defense when the police come into our neighborhoods and attempt to murder our children and our families and so forth. And one of the other things we did was we involved ourselves in a prisoner movement, which was led by George Jackson, who at that time was a field marshal for the Black Panther Party. And George Jackson, of course, talked about the prisoner, that he was a prisoner within a prison within a prison. He was in that prison. And he talked about how we had to develop ways, as he put it, as many of these prisoners quoted him, even in Georgia, talked about how we had to set aside our differences, understand our common oppression, and rise up together. And George Jackson did that. And his murder in August of 1971 was so powerful that it inspired an uprising at Attica State Prison in New York, as many of you may remember, in September of 1971. Unfortunately, when these men took over one wing of Attica and demanded, and what did they demand? Same thing the guys in Georgia did. What did they demand? They demanded better food, nutritional food, decent place to sleep, the end of cruel and unusual punishments. They wanted education. This is what these men asked for in Georgia, and they wanted to be paid for their labor. That's what they mainly focused on in Georgia. And then, of course, the governor of New York, then Rockefeller, sent in some troops, and in a couple of minutes, they mowed down 40 people and ended that one-week uprising a couple weeks ago. It wasn't Attica. And the same thing in Lucasville, Ohio. They sat down, well, they took over a wing of the prison. So the men in Georgia decided that they would be something different. But just to finish this up, excuse me, by 1981, we could say there wasn't any real movement in America. The Black Panther Party was dead. There wasn't any real prisoner movement. I don't know what happened to the women's movement. Saying nothing against the welfare reform, you don't even have a gay movement anymore. You know, except for these few people who are running around now because they can't get married. We used to have gay, we used to unite the Black Panther Party, believe it or not. Was the only organization, black organization certainly, and progressive organization that identified gay liberation as a part of our struggle, just as we did women's liberation and all the other things. Where are those movements? We don't have one anymore. We don't even have anti-war, nothing. So when we look at what happened in Georgia, it was really an aberration. I mean, how did these people even figure out how to do anything in this environment of absolute, what do I want to say? There's moral bankruptcy, the absence of any kind of action for anything. And so there was this uprising. And it became so big, at least for me, because it showed me that there was a spark still left, but nothing has happened on the outside. I attempted to form an organization, we call it Concerned Coalition to Respect Prisoners' Rights. It was supposed to be to protect, but the person who typed up, I'm not making this up, set up a Facebook, put the wrong word in, so we had to go along with to respect prisoners' rights. And we started talking about how we could now use this opportunity to organize people around the rights of prisoners. It's human rights, just to have decent food and to get an education beyond a GED, to get paid for their labor, not to be slave, acting as though they were slaves and not to be working like slaves. This is the kind of thing we're talking about. That has almost fallen apart. The energy level is not there. People don't want to do it. So the question is, as we look over all this, where do we go from here? That's the question that Dr. King has that I'd like to go back to. Before his assassination, you know, a lot of people think King was killed because of the, because he was against the war or because of the Memphis strike or whatever. No, King was organizing something before he was killed. It was called the Poor People's Campaign. You know, Lyndon Johnson, we have to know this. There were three people killed around the time that, for those 4 years that Lyndon Johnson was. I mean, that was like an interesting thing. The first Kennedy gets killed and Lyndon Johnson becomes president. Then they all have the same thing. The known gunman that figured out this incredible way to kill this person. He was like, got King, killed King. He was on the balcony. He was supposed to be on the first floor. He was supposed to be in another hotel. But James Earl Ray figured out how to kill King, who had no skills whatsoever with weapons. And you know, it's very hard to hit somebody with a bullet at that distance unless you're really good. And there was no evidence that James Earl Ray was that good enough, not to count psychic and knew where King would be staying. But anyway. Yes, before he was killed, King was organizing the Poor People's Campaign. And what was the theme of the Poor People's Campaign? It was like, Whosoever will, let him come. We are poor people in America, and we need our money. He said, we need some guaranteed income. You are putting all these billions of dollars into war, and you can't find us a job. If you can't get me a job, then somebody needs to give me some money to live on. I need guaranteed income. That's a pretty radical statement, isn't it? Matter of fact, he's getting ready to be communistic. Because he then talks about a guaranteed health care, not health insurance, health care. And then he talks about the redistribution of the wealth of this nation. Now, you know, when you start talking like that, your name is Martin Luther King, you are creating a problem. And you start bringing white people and Native Americans and black people, Latinos and everybody and their mother, talking about you coming to Washington, D.C., and we're not moving until we get our, we're coming to get our check and cash our check. That's what he said. Now, nobody remembers this part about King. They just remember about the little kid bumping on the mountain and whatever you do. Remember the part about nonviolence, especially if you're black. What Dr. King really was talking about was what the Black Panther Party was talking about. There has to be some type of fundamental change here. You cannot have these people in prison and think that we can continue to go on like this and imprison people and murder people around the world, and this is all right with us. We have to be geared towards some type of change that isn't just piecemeal but fundamental. And I want to close with something that he said at that period of his life, Dr. King. There was a story in the Bible of a man who came to Jesus and said, Jesus, I understand that you're in the business of saving people who have sinned. I've committed a lot of sins. You think you can save me? And this is me quoting Dr. King, quoting the Bible now. That's not what the Bible said. That's not what King said. And Jesus said, no, Nicodemus, I can't save you. You have to be born again. You committed so many sins, you can't even be fixed. And Dr. King says, when I look at America today, and I see the poverty, and I see the lack of education, and I see the war, and I see all these things that are terrible things going on, I say, America, you're going to have to be born again. Mm. All right, thank you very much.
We'd like to thank Will Munger and others from the Counterinsurgency Convergence, and of course, Elaine Brown. For more information about her role in the Black Panther Party, her work with Little B and other political prisoners, as well as many lectures and other resources, go to elainebrown.org.
You have been listening to Circle A Radio, which airs the first and third Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We can be contacted through the website kboo.fm/CircleA Radio or at CircleA Radio@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening.